State of Podcast tells the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success and gleans what we can about the working practices of the greats from those who were in close proximity when the magic was being made. The podcast also aims to extract key advice and information to help future generation of musicians in an increasingly complex industry. For more episodes featuring musicians who've worked closely with the likes of David Bowie, Elvis, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, many, many more, go to thestageofpodcast.com, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @thestageofpod. We found out this week that we actually have 86,000 subscribers on iTunes. Genuinely didn't think we had any, so that was a bit of a surprise, nearly fell off my chair. So big love to you guys. Please get in touch, and also spread the word if you can. That really helps the podcast growth. Read a couple of books about growing podcasts this week, and one of the key things is to get reviews on iTunes. So if anyone can spend 2 minutes just writing a nice review on there, that'd be really appreciated. If you don't like the podcast, probably bypass that. Okay, I'm really proud to say who I've got on next on this episode of the podcast. It's Mr. G. Genuinely someone that I think's a bit of a genius, I've got to be honest. And he came around my place and we had a great chat. So I hope you enjoy the episode. This is Mr. G.
Two red robins awoke early one morning, father and son sharing a moment of calling, in the magical hours between dewdrops and dawn when all is calm with the world. Said son to father, "Dad, why do we sing and puff up our chest and limber up our wings when it seems to me to be a bird is but a lowly thing when man is in charge of this world? He builds a nest so high that it can make love to the sky. He wears feathers in all shapes and all colours and sizes. His wings are invisible, but yet he can fly so high, so why should we sing in this world?" Said father to son, "Yeah, man indeed is strong. He has the pride of a peacock and the grace of a swan. He even goes a little cuckoo when the weather goes wrong, for he believes that he's in charge of this world. He puts a feather in his cap as he tries to rule the roost, but whenever he gets scared, he feels the bump of a goose, because we used to be dinosaurs, and that's the truth. And my son, that's why we'll always sing in this world."
Okay, welcome to a very special lyric writing based episode of the Stage Left podcast. Today we are joined by the ludicrously gifted spoken word artist and poet laureate from the Russell Brand Show, Mr. G. Today we'll be finding out what it was like to be the first poet to perform alone on a stage to 15,000 people at the O2, what it was like performing a poem about peace to the House of the Parliament, how Martin Luther King's final speech influenced G's work, and what advice G would give to young lyricists and poets. We'll be also talking about Russell Brand, poetic conversations with Noel Gallagher, and Mr. G will even be performing a couple of poems live for us. So it's a pleasure to say our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is the jaw-droppingly talented Mr. G. Thanks for joining today, G. How's it going?
It's going really good, Chris. Thanks for that amazing intro. I couldn't have written a better one myself, even though I tried to send you one. Yeah.
Okay, so obviously you know about the podcast. I mean, we've had a lot of drummers and bassists and, and producers on and that kind of thing. And I wanted to do one that was based around lyrics. And I was listening to I've listened to a lot of your work in the past anyway. And I can't think of someone better to kind of tap into the knowledge of, given that you've done obviously some amazing things in the poetry world in the last few years. I want to begin with a quote from when you interviewed Billy Bragg, and he said writing poetry and writing love songs, I don't think there's a huge amount of difference. Obviously there are differences. Yeah. I wonder if you could compare and contrast the two.
Writing poetry and writing love songs. Well, I guess, wow, I think that, you know, poetry comes from a point of passion, and you know, you have to have a sort of like a passion or a feeling about something, and I guess that's what you're trying to convey to the listener or the reader or the audience. You know, you're taking a passion about something and you're trying to translate it into the right set of words and phrases and, you know, little tricks that you use and put it forward to an audience. But I still have this, when it comes to writing a song, I do believe that the melody dictates the spirit of what it is you're trying to write.
Interesting.
So you can take very nonsensical lyrics and put them over a beautiful melody, and it will move people. Whereas when I'm performing poetry, like, you know, from my craft, the spoken word poetry scene, you know, the music is stripped away, and so you have to, like, find the melody within the words, but the meaning of the words carry a lot more weight than they do within a song.
Fantastic. And what about, are there any key differences from a technical point of view in writing?
Nah, I wouldn't think so. I think that that anyone that's ever tried to write anything, be it a screenplay or a book or a poem or like even a comedy routine, it is you facing the page or you facing the laptop or whatever your means of transcribing your words is. And I think that that process is very pure. You know, you're trying to channel something within yourself. And I think that process, that's why you can get a comedian admiring a musician and a musician admiring film dialogue. And you can get all this, like, this cross-pollination of writers from different, different genres.
Yeah.
And you can get them respecting each other because they know that when that person was sitting down writing that bit of dialogue for that film or writing that poem or writing that book or writing that song, it was just them alone in a room facing the oblivion within the blank screen or the oblivion within the empty page and just trying to find a way to fill the void.
You were just telling me before we started recording that when you do a lot of the Russell Brand podcasts and the Russell Brand shows, some of the people who are listening in, that you can tell the writers who are listening in because they're the ones that kind of latch on to what you do. Because for those who haven't listened to the Russell Brand show or the Russell Brand podcast, G often sits in the corner having to kind of compose a poem, very much improvised, about a lot of content that is improvised itself. And yeah. You're kind of in the last minute or so, you've got to put to work. And it's an amazing skill you have. I mean,
I'm amazed that people even latched onto it, because the show was improvised comedy between Russell and Matt and improvised poetry at the end. And what I, you know, most of those poems, I'll be honest with you, man, they were written within like 10 minutes. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I take notes throughout the whole show,
yeah,
but trying to piece it together and trying to form like some kind of like capture a spirit of what's occurred, and that was literally done in like in 10 minutes. So it was a lot of them are a blur. So I get people quote lines back to me, and that's why I know that they're lyricists, because only a lyricist will pick up on, oh, I can see what he's trying to do. And I used to throw loads of different hidden references in as well.
From the show,
from obscure kung fu movies, from 90s hip-hop tracks, from philosophy, all types of things that I knew sometimes us as guys were chatting about, maybe off-air or something like that. So I'm trying to get something to make Matt smile, get something to make Russ smile, get something to make people that know me smile, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is totally obscure. And someone would like write me, back in those days, I think it was on MySpace, they'd send me a MySpace message saying, oh, I noticed that you reference blah, 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 blah. And I think, oh, that guy's a writer, or that girl's a writer, you know?
Amazing. It's an amazing talent how you put it together at the end. Many times I've been sat on the tube hearing that last minute or so, and my jaw is on the floor. It's absolutely incredible.
Oh, thank you.
Cool. So you got into poetry quite late, is that right? Because you're already doing a job in scaffolding and that kind of thing.
That was my thing. I was just delivering scaffolding. I used to DJ. That was my main. I'm not really, sounds weird, even though like I do a lot of talking, I guess, for a living now. But I was, I'm not really a very talkative person. The idea of going up on stage and talking didn't really interest me that much. I like to be the guy that would just DJ, play the tunes. That's how I would express myself.
Yeah.
And we used to put on these nights where like a singer would come and do a PA or an MC would come and do a PA and I'd be there DJing. And then one, fateful night, there was a guy that wanted to propose to his girlfriend and he wanted to read her a poem during one of our nights. And he wanted us to stop the music and read a poem.
What, in like a nightclub?
Yeah, in a nightclub, right? And we're just like, dude, man, we can't be stopping music, people dancing, and then have you read a poem. So, obviously whispering behind his back saying, suppose the poem's whack, suppose she says no, you know what I mean, right? So what we did is we created a fake poetry night where I was part of a DJ crew and we all got together and we all read a poem each, and then he reads his poem and then he proposes to her, gets down on one knee, opens up the ring, she said yes, and then people enjoyed the night and people really enjoyed the poetry. And that's what got me into the whole idea of performing a poem in a nightclub scenario.
And had you written a poem before that? Before the time you did?
I'd written lyrics. I mean, I love lyricism. I grew up on hip hop, right?
Right?
So that's my means of entering world culture, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I loved lyrics, but I never thought that there would be anything that I would be able to write that would impact me the way, or impact an audience the way in which a rap song or a song would impact me.
So what age were you when you wrote your first poem?
This is going way back. I might be like, I don't know, like 9, 10. I used to write loads of poems about Jesus.
So you were doing it around
I wrote poems about Jesus, a lot of my poems. Yeah, they got published,
really.
Yeah, but they were real religious ones,
Okay. And then so when you went into the kind of MC and DJ and that kind of thing, tell us about those days.
Oh, those days were good days, because I guess they were like the transition between carrying loads of records in record boxes and setting up, you know, you'd have to set up speakers and set up PAs and stuff like that. So being a DJ, like we talk about like old men now, like that, it was a serious thing. You had to rent a van out. Yep. You had to go to the warehouse and pick up the speakers and go and pick up the amps and pick up the modulators and all that kind of stuff and get all this equipment, bring it to a hall, set it all up, and then, you know, you've got your crates and crates and crates of records, and then just start playing. I remember one time I was playing in Brixton, and we were playing in a hall, and there was a power cut, right?
Right.
And so we're playing to a bunch of teenagers, right, you know? And there was this power cut, so nothing's working. And you just felt this hush in the air. And me and my friends were like going, oh my God, we've got like a couple of grand's worth of equipment in here and there's no power. And you've got all these kids in here just looking like, that's a nice pair of turntables you got. Do you know what I mean? Right? So it's one of those things where I think we faked a fire alarm, because a fire alarm has got its own emergency supply. Do you know what I mean? Of electricity, which doesn't require like the normal fuses. And so I think we punched the fire alarm, set the fire alarm off, cleared the hall. Me and my friends just packed all the stuff, got in the van and just drove out rather than get robbed.
Wow, amazing. So some classic days there. And so, from a musical point of view, when you listen to music and when you're DJing, what lyricists then, I know you said you kind of refer to hip-hop then, who are the ones that kind of planting the seeds then that, you know, you're now a poet, who was really influencing you then as a lyricist?
I mean, I grew up on like late 80s, early 90s hip-hop, so I loved KRS-One, I loved Rakim, I loved Big Daddy Kane, Chuck D I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
The main MC that I loved was Ice Cube from N.W.A.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved Ice Cube. I'm probably the biggest Ice Cube fan ever.
Really?
Most people don't know that. Yeah, because they don't associate my style of writing with Ice Cube's, you know, being a fan of Ice Cube. But again, it's about appreciating storytelling. I like storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I can take, you know, bragging and boasting, I just take that as being part of male bravado. But anyone that can take me and write a story, then you've got me. And so some of the stories he used to tell, I just love them within rhyme.
A lot of your stuff is very thought-provoking as well. You know, it leaves a lot of, you know, you do sit there and kind of have a good think afterwards. You're kind of making some important cultural points. Who was influencing you then that was doing the same to you?
Well, I guess, there's so many, like hip-hop's got like a pantheon of, you've got the Commons, you've got the Mos Defs, you've got, Talib Kweli, you've got, you know, Razkaz, you've got, there's Ice-T, you know, then the Jay-Z's, you know, Eminem, you know, the Marshall Mathers album is like, you know, one of the greatest albums that, musically, that's, you know, that's ever been made. There's just so many. Anything that tells a great story. Like, I love, there's a track by Common called Testify, right?
Okay.
You know? And it's just about a courtroom scenario, right? And it takes you one way, and then right at the end, it swings you another way. It's just a great piece of storytelling,
narrative, yeah?
Yeah, narrative. Nas, I mean, I went to see Nas. He came to the Roundhouse not too long ago. Mm. Went to see him perform. He used to have a track called Rewind, and the track, it starts off at the end, and he goes backwards throughout the whole day. So it starts off at the end of what's happening and he's going backwards and he's telling you what the time is and whatever, and he takes you. So anything that's kind of clever, anything that hits you with a feeling, a concept, something that stretches your mind, I like stuff like that.
Mm.
But then again, I like, you know, jump up and shake your ass type of stuff as well. Because the way I look at it is that, like, music needs to, you know, capture the whole spectrum of human experience and whole spectrum of human emotion.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, when you just want to, you know, you're in your car and you're just driving really fast and you just want to just listen to some rubbish, do you know what I'm saying, right? Well, not rubbish, but you want to listen to something that is testosterone-filled, you know what I mean, right? Because, I mean, like, say, what's his name? Who's a Lemmy just died, right?
Yeah.
I still like Motorhead, right? Yeah. I like Megadeth, Slayer. I went to see Anthrax and Metallica when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right? Because you want that something that's just going to just get all the blood rushing. You know what I'm saying? You want that feeling, right?
Yeah.
And for me, a poem might not be able to do that, right? But Tony Iommi riff, you know what I mean? Might hit it in the way in which, you know, that you can't. So I think people tap into entertainment to just try and feel something.
So talk about hip-hop. You're now going to perform The Day Hip-Hop Lied. Is that right? Is that the name of it?
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that poem.
Well, that poem, I guess, is me becoming, reflective, because obviously when I got into, when I first started listening to, gangster rap and stuff like that, it was real exciting, and I felt that it was real, I thought it was real provocative, because it was basically the music industry just saying, fuck you, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's always entertaining to hear. But then you start realizing that it's talking about situations, and it's talking about, you get older, so you start to become wary of the misogyny, you start to become wary of the violence, and I don't mind there being a place for it, but I think there always needs to be a counterbalance. That's why it might seem that a lot of my stuff is very lofty and maybe like I'm going deep on the intellectual tip. It's because I listen to a lot of the dumb stuff, and so I'm just trying to provide some kind of a balance.
Yeah. Okay.
And so this poem was about me looking at the music that I love with a critical eye and criticising it, but then recognising that there needs to be a balance at the end.
This is Mr. G performing The Day Hip Hop Lied.
You lied to me. You told me I could waste my days endlessly blinging in luxury and say keep it real, when really I kept a fantasy locked in my head of a lifestyle never led. But it is constantly desired, as it is constantly fed into my system. My dear sweet sisters, I diss them, for my desire for the lie forces me to dismiss them and never kiss them, only twist them when they feel my rhythm. When I'm in them, all I give them is attraction and cataclysm. You lied to me. You told me I could be a drug dealer and be admired and feared by all the people, appeal to the jewelry round my neck and cruelty gets respect. Diamond studded bracelets place the fools to be in check and wear the latest in clothes, because my wealth must be shown. For it's the jealousy of others that excel my throne. You said such gain was the path, and joy and wealth was one of the same built to last, keeping my brothers held down, for their misery composes my crown. Their desire to be me exposes their frown, but every time they see me driving around, we all keep hating one another, love strives to be found. You lied. You told me I'd get head every day from any gorgeous model, you said, whose head twirled my way, and that there was honor amongst thugs who knelt and prayed together and dealt drugs and would survive the game. It's a crying shame, but respectfully, if I'm half drunk and half high, 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 that's all others now expect of me, believing the lie that no matter how high I rise, I'm still ghettoized. You never told me about the hard work to fund my hard play and fund the child support that would fund my baby, and how they keep switching the fashion that leaves me itching to grab them. So my riches you grab by manipulating my mind. In this heaven that you promise is only hell that I find, the jealousy I see demolishes communities' mindset to build and abolish the poverty of our kind. Don't get me wrong. I was raised on your songs. I felt so brave and so strong when they blazed for so long. But this phase can't go on. We need to plant some more corn. The lies you feed me, they bleed me and lead me to do wrong. But then I hear your sweet beats, and I remember why. You said to survive on the streets, I had to be wise to all lies, and even if some of them bear the most familiar disguise, sometimes to keep it real, you got to criticize the lies.
Beautiful. Thanks for that, Jay. So, growing up, what were your ambitions?
Well, my ambitions. Oh, my God. That's such a weird thing to say. I don't know. I don't have ambitions like that.
What were they when you
were a kid? What were they?
Yeah, yeah.
Man, I used to.
Because you didn't foresee that you were going to be a poet.
No, I didn't see performing or doing stuff on radio or touring and all that kind of stuff. I'll be honest, I'm going to sound so limiting, but just staying alive. I'll be honest with you, just staying alive, right? Like I used to say to my friends that all I needed was a sunny day, a full tank of petrol, and a couple of hours to do nothing, and I'm happy. You know what I mean?
Good.
Because that's what I want. I just wanted to be happy, hang out with my friends, go to a club, talk to pretty girls. That's it. I never had those big, the big questions of the universe never presented themselves to me.
Yeah.
And it's only, I suppose, when you start, like, what got me into poetry was doing a mind-numbing job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where you're doing a job which is just like, I'm delivering scaffolding, I'm, talking to, builders all the time that are just, it's that kind of banter. It's amusing for a little while, and after a while it just becomes... You just think to yourself, wow, ain't you guys thinking about nothing else? Ain't you got any hopes? And I'm now asking, don't you have any hopes, dreams, aspirations? Is this all there is to life? Just going to pub, getting drunk, getting high? Just, is that it? Is that is that all we're going to ever do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you see the older dudes that used to do that, and now they're just hanging outside the off licenses, drinking Jack Daniels, you know what I'm saying, and trying to get a little bit of change together to scratch a lottery card and hope they can win it and then buy more Jack Daniels, you know? So then I started asking myself the big, huge questions of the universe, being trapped in a boring job. But well, as a teenager, I just wanted to have fun.
Good stuff. So once you'd done that first poem and then you kind of decided you want to perform more, tell us about some of those experiences, because I know some of that you played some interesting gigs in your time. I know, did you play like a heavy metal night?
Yeah. You know, because as I said, like,
how did that come?
I think someone contacted me. I think they were like a fan of the show, right? Probably a songwriter. It's always songwriters that like me. And they liked the poetry, and then they invited me down to, was it Metal Fest in Camden? And I've, you know, you say I grew up on hardcore hip hop and, you know, thrash metal. That's what I liked. And so I thought, yeah, sure, man. And you know, it was some of the band members there, I knew people that knew them or whatever, and then we got together and we were all talking about different concerts we've been to, and so it was a great night, like proper headbanging, you know, killer riffs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I guess they made the mistake where they just stopped the music and then they said, okay, now we're going to have Mr. G doing some poetry. So I came out and I'm there doing my poems, and the audience are hyped up. And it's on YouTube, you can see it. But there was this woman that was just yelling abuse at me throughout my whole act.
Really?
But obviously, because the mic's pointed to me, you can't hear her. So she's just yelling and yelling and yelling. And she was motioning to throw some beer at me, right? And so, like, I'm there trying to do the poem, and I'm doing these weird moves. Every time I do, like, a weird move to the left or to the right, it's because I keep thinking, oh, shit, she's going to throw, a pint of beer at me. And I think she threw it, and it missed. And the guy next to me, he threw some beer at her. And then someone, I don't know, was drinking a bottle of water or something like that, and I walked up to him and I got the bottle of water, and she's trapped because she's surrounded by, you know, that room was packed, he had a couple hundred people in it, and I just took the bottle of water and I was still reciting the poem, I just poured it over her head.
Did you?
Right, yeah. Poured it over her head, right?
How did she react?
She's screaming, she's yelling, cussing, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But you know what was good about it was that it just sort of let everyone know that, like, this guy is going to fight back. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it chilled the room out afterwards, you
really?
Know? Because it's just one of those things, because I didn't stop performing. So all the time I'm pouring this water over her head, I'm just reciting the poem. And, you know, such is my curse. The poem is a beautiful poem. It's about alienation. It's about, you know what I mean? It's about, you know, feeling those deeper inner emotions. But my actions was one of, like, you know, I guess like an angry male, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Cool. So you said that you hadn't kind of had ambitions of ever performing live. How did you find those first kind of, so the first year of doing it, performing live in front of people? That must have been quite a strange thing for you. And how did you kind of settle into it? Do you feel comfortable even doing it now?
No, I struggle with it. I do struggle because the nerves are terrible. Stage fright, man. I mean, you know, as you know, you're performing yourself, and you know that I don't think that anybody ever gets over that kind of fear of...
But what is the fear?
The fear... I think the fear is because it's an unnatural situation. Like, to put yourself, I think that, you know, we're born with, you know, was it fight or flight tendencies, right? And so to put yourself in the crosshairs of the audience, then that is the fear.
I think with what you do, I mean, I saw you at the Camden Roundhouse support Russell Brand.
Yeah.
And I think you put yourself really, you're in a vulnerable position there as a poet on that stage when it's kind of a load of people going to a comedy gig.
Yeah.
And you pulled it off, man. Like, you know, yeah, it's a tough gig because I walked in and there's people, as you say, like a bit like the Metal Gig, but, you know, boomed up and ready for a comedy night. And, like, you're doing poetry. It's just like, you're brave to do that. Well, and you pull it off, man.
Well, I set a hard rod for my back because... I've come up through the spoken word poetry scene, so I always want to represent that. Do you know what I mean?
Cool.
So as much as I can appreciate, I love comedy. I'm a big fan of comedy. I've seen so many comedians. You know what I mean? And I love comedy. I'm not a comedian, and so I have elements of humor that I will drop in my set, but. Fundamentally, I always want to be recognized as a poet.
Yeah.
And so it was even when we were doing the radio show, like, I could very easily have just written every single punchline on the radio show. I could have just strung every punchline together that Matt and Russ said, put it into a rhyme, and bang, give it out there. But this stupid dumbness inside me that says, I want to be appreciated as a poet, and I want there to be a concept, and I want there to be a narrative, and I want to to deal with the abstract as opposed to the blatant. You know what I mean, right? And so that's the rod I set for myself. And
but that's what makes you brilliant, man.
Don't, when it works, it works. No, but like everyone else, we had bad gigs. Do you know what I'm saying? I've done gigs where I've gone out there. Actually, I did once did a hip hop gig, right? Where I went out there and I did the day Hip Hop Live. So all the hip hop fans loved it. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, they just go, yeah, this is what we want to hear. And I'm there thinking that, and this is a proper, this is like South London, hoodie tops, do you know what I'm saying? Big baseball jackets, you know what I'm saying? Everyone's there looking all mean, you know, gold teeth in their mouth and everything. And I did the day Hip Hop Live and I thought, right, I've got them with this poem. Now I'm going to give them a love poem. Oh my God, it was so difficult, man. It was such a struggle.
To get through to the end.
I powered my way through to the end, but they wanted to just, they didn't mind hearing the conscious lyrics with an XY chromosome bravado behind it, but to do a gentle love poem where your emotions are on display, they couldn't handle that. You know what I mean?
But it's interesting you say that, like, the nerves get you, because you are making a lot of brave decisions when you're choosing your gigs, and that's a brave decision to do that. What advice would you give to people who perhaps are nervous for gigs, or, like, you know, is there anything that you do, you have any techniques to get over that, or what are you learning as you go along?
I'd say throw yourself on stage, right? Because I mean, 5 minutes is a long time, you know, like, especially when you're doing, like, I've done comedy gigs as well, right? Like no poetry, just I tried doing comedy just to see if I could do it. Throw yourself on stage, and I think you need to die on stage. If you haven't died, then it's going to haunt you, like the fear of dying will haunt you. But dying on stage is a very, it's almost like a religious experience, because you stand there and the crowd are against you, right? Someone might be yelling or booing for you to get off, you know, and you just stand there and then you just look at them, and it's almost like the light, it's like, the spotlight's on you, and you're up there and you're just going, wow, man, I'm really ruining these people's day here, man, you know? And your brain just starts thinking really quickly. And you once you come off, you know, like I once did Jongleurs.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So I did Jongleurs in Battersea on a Friday night, right?
Okay.
And I went up there and I did my little comedy routine. The crowd are laughing. Then I figured, okay, man, let me do a poem. They didn't like the poem.
Really?
And there was like jeering and whatever and blah, 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 blah. And it was just, it was savage. I got a savage heckling, right? And I couldn't break the poem and deal with the heckling, so I had to get through the poem, then try and deal with the heckling. And it looked like I'm dealing with a heckle that's occurred in a minute, and a minute's a long time on stage, right? And so afterwards, I remember there were these two gay guys, they were on after me, and it was like a comedy competition, and they won the competition, right? They came on after me, and they stormed it, and they won, and they won a bottle of champagne. And I remember afterwards in the dressing room, man, they just gave me the champagne and goes, look, kid, just take this because I know you're going to need it. You know what I'm saying? It was pretty savage out there. You know what I mean, right? But I think that you need to have that experience, because what it is you start to find your voice and find yourself on stage. You know, so you go on stage and that's like it's like the stage has given birth to you, right? You know, you've just been born and you're on stage, and then you take your little baby steps on stage, then you stumble and you fall over, and then you realise, okay, every now and then I'm going to need a drink of water, every now and then I'm going to have to get my breath right, every now and then soon you start standing up as a performer and you start realising, okay, this is who I am, right? You're not going to get laughs a minute out of me, you know what I mean? You're not going to get me to sing, you're not going to get me to dance, you know? What I do is I'm going to entertain you through the words of poetry, and I will find a way to entertain you, even if it kills me.
And that makes you really unique, man. That's your unique thing. Cool. You've said in the past that in the world of poetry, there is a civil war in the world of poetry.
Oh, yeah.
So I wonder if you could tell us about that. You don't have to name the person, but there was an incident where...
Yeah, I've been very, very lucky in terms of my career in that I hosted a very prestigious poetry show on Radio 4.
Yeah, cool. You
know, Bespoken Word.
Bespoken Word,
So that allowed me to meet several well-known poets, you know, people that, you know, I met Pete Doherty there because he was a poet before he was the Libertines, right? Met the Benjamin Zephaniah, John Cooper Clarke's, you know, I met some amazing writers. And I also met very established writers who are published. So it got me into contact with them. Now, obviously, they ain't never heard of me, right? Because I'm not published. I'm not on the written scene. And so they're asking me, what do you do, all right? And I'm like, okay, yeah, I do, you know, a little bit on the Russell Brand Show. And I think I was in the West End. Then I would go do a little thing on the West End. And I think I'd recited a poem. And there's a snobbishness whereby people who are published feel that they are better poets, right? Or they've got more credibility than people who aren't published, right? Okay. And to me, I don't see the Matrix like that, or I see the Matrix for what it is. It's just ones and zeros. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Right? And one can't exist unless it's can be compared to a zero. A one doesn't know it's one unless there's a zero near it, right? And so I was just trying to explain to this guy, look, we both just manipulate words. That's what we do. And we try to achieve an emotion. And the minute you step up on a stage and you read a poem, you're a performer as far as I'm concerned, right? And if you just stand up on a stage and read flatly from a book, you're not entertaining the audience. You're not respecting the stage, right? And likewise, if I take my words, which are spoken, and I put them into a book and they don't work, I'm not respecting the page, right? So sometimes I'll have to adjust my words to get them onto the page. Likewise, you as a written artist, that's what I said to the guy, will have to adjust your words to get them to work on the stage. I said, but we're both playing around with words. That's all we're doing.
How did that land?
It didn't land well, because obviously, you know, this guy's quoting that, you know, Oxford, have you spoken at Oxford and he's spoken at Cambridge? And I'm like, well, dude, I work with the BBC. I've spoken at Oxford and Cambridge too. You've done, I've probably done through the medium of spoken word, right? But we're both poets at the end of the day. And, you know, I gave a whole TED talk about it where I just tried to just project ourselves 10,000 years into the future and just say, what are people going to remember of us in 10,000 years' time? In 10,000 years' time, you know, they might not be in England in 10,000 years' time. They might not, you know, Christianity, Islam, these might have blurred into some new Jedi religion. Do you know what I'm saying? Right? So all we've got to give...
That'd be amazing if that...
Yeah, it would. You know, I've always got my lightsabers ready, you know what I'm saying, for that day, right? You know? Right? But all we've got is our words and our feelings and the emotions we're trying to convey. So are we trying to increase the love in this world or decrease the love in this world? You do it via the page, I do it via the stage.
Yes, it's such a shame that was the attitude of that person, but so a lot of your poetry lands and kind of hits home with some thought-provoking stuff, as I've mentioned before. And one really cool thing you did was you did a poem about peace at the Houses of Parliament.
How did
that come about, and how did that land?
This is 2014, so it was 100 years on from the First World War. And there was this convention where it was called a Pledge for Peace. And so all these eminent people got together and they wanted to declare this pledge for peace. And there was a speaker there called Prem Rawat. And
you interviewed him, didn't you?
I interviewed him, because there's a church. Well, it used to be a church. It got bombed during the 1993 Bishopsgate bomb. It's called St. Ethelberg's Church, and it got bombed by the IRA. And so they turned it into a place of peace and conciliation. So it's non-denomination, right? And so you will have people from Israel meeting people from Palestine there. You'll have people from the situation in Sri Lanka. I think it was the Tamils and the Sinhalese. You'll have them meeting there, right? And you're basically any warring factions, right, can meet there and talk on a peaceful level. So I used to do lots of performances there.
Wow.
Right? And so the person who was in charge of that place, I forgot his name. His name was Andrew. I forgot his last name, right? He was invited to the House of Parliament. So he invited me to go along and read this poem, which is called, you know, Citizen G. And, I read it out there. And, it basically just boils down to the fact that, like, doesn't matter what labels we want to give each other, you know, black, white, Asian, northerner, southerner, Londoner, Mancurian, Liverpudlian, gay, straight, bi, transgender, man, female, male, female, doesn't matter what label we try to give each other, you strip it all down, we're humans. Do you know what I'm saying? We eat, we sleep, we breathe, we love, we hate, we, do you know what I mean? We've got core emotions and core things that unite us all together. And place and locality and territory, you know, those things aren't more important than our humanity.
I know that one of your poems is inspired by Martin Luther King's final speech. It's actually something I studied myself and at uni 6 or 7 years ago. Yeah. And it's really interesting because his final speech, which was recorded only hours before he was killed, he actually says, "Don't go out and buy Coca-Cola."
Yeah.
Which is absolutely amazing.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Fascinating. Yeah. Now, I did a whole project on the difference between the music industry and other industries. And so I compared EMI to a non-music industry or company. And I did Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And one thing I kind of found out about this was this quote from Martin Luther King. And I don't know if you know, when Barack Obama was elected as the first black president, a few years ago, Coca-Cola, the day after he was elected, ran an advert which was a split screen, and on the left you had key images and key people in relation to the black civil rights movement, from Rosa Parks all the way through to Barack Obama being elected.
Yeah.
To the right hand side of the screen, the evolution of the Coke bottle,
right,
and midway through, Martin Luther King's image is used.
Wow.
And the whole point of the advert was then to say kind of, oh, we've been shoulder to shoulder with this movement
all the way along,
even though in his literally some of his final words with "Don't go out and buy Coca-Cola." And I know you said it's quite difficult to find that whole speech, and I think that you said that you could only find the transcript. I've actually got the original speech.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, to listen to. So I can send it to you. Actually, I'll show you.
Oh, man, thanks a lot, man.
It's 6 minutes long, but I won't play it all now.
Yeah.
But what I will do is I'll play you a little bit of when he actually says it. So,
make the first item on your agenda fair treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. And so as a result of this, we're asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola in Memphis.
There you go. And so this poem was kind of influenced by that speech because it was kind of anti-corporate message from Martin Luther King. Tell us a bit about writing this poem.
Well, writing this poem, you know, I'm a big fan of Martin Luther King, because I see that the Martin Luther King that's presented to us is just, you know, I have a dream, and you know, the little black boy, little black girl, and you know, all togetherness and stuff like that, right? Whereas he was a man that was, like, I guess, of his time and grappling with the idea of the future, and he's got the government on one side, do you know what I mean, that aren't wanting to give an inch or give a millimetre, do you know what I'm saying, right? Then he's got the extremists, do you know what I mean, on the other side, you know what I mean? So we've got the Black Panther movement and the Malcolm X side or whatever. So I saw him as being pulled between two ways of thinking. And on the one hand, he's thinking like, okay, I need to... I will talk to the people that are on the more, you know, extreme level of saying, oh, let's get some guns and just go kill some white folks, right? You know what I mean? And then I've got I'm talking to the government that are thinking, let's get the army and send them into the neighbourhoods and go kill black people. Do you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
And I just saw this guy in the middle of it all, plus he's having problems at home, do you know what I'm saying, right? He, you know, it's well documented that he had, you know, many affairs and stuff like that. There was points where his wife was about to leave him.
Yep.
The FBI were tapping his phone. They sent...
they were terrified of him, weren't
exactly.
They?
They sent a recording of some, I think, some woman that, you know,
the woman,
you know, and, you know, played in front of his wife and whatever.
Really?
Yeah, seriously. That's what I'm saying.
I didn't know that.
He was going through some stuff. And so I just wrote this poem where it's almost like his last speech was, I've been to the mountaintop, right? And realistically, the mountaintop isn't just the idea of the racial problem, it's just the obstacles that you face in life. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he wasn't a rich man, you know what I mean? Mm. So he's problems with the rent, problems with, you know, how to feed his children, problems with the family, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Those are normal obstacles, you know what I'm saying, right? That everyone faces. And so it's just the idea that there's the mountain you perceive that he had to overcome, and then there's a mountain of just living that he had to overcome as well.
Mm.
So this poem is very, it doesn't mention Martin Luther King at all,
yeah,
but it's very abstract, right?
Yeah.
Because it's just about trying to overcome the obstacles in life. And I think that's what makes a man, or that's what makes a woman. When you triumph over adversity, then that's what makes you a champion.
Top stuff. So you're going to perform this poem for us now?
Yeah, right. This poem is at Go Tell It on the Mountain. I caught the falling feather of an angel's wing, and I wanted it tattooed upon my spine. Now you can call me a devil or a demonic thing. Who cares for names if I can fly? Who cares for names if I can rise and claim what's rightfully mine? Beyond the foot of this crooked mountain which casts a haze upon my life, you know it's impacting how I'm living. You know it's exact and unforgiving. It traps my soul within a box and it holds a lock to my upliftment. I just want to float away so high. I just want to break the colour lines. I want to break the minimum wage and slavery, break the cannons, guns and knives, that I can escape the prison time. Escape the trips to courtroom trials, that I can rewind the school exclusions when daddy leaves and mommy cries. Am I wrong to want to escape this plight? These angel wings give me insight. They levitate my mental state to leave these shackles far behind, but fallen wings leave scattered feathers. And I tried my best to just collect them, but they were spread oh so far apart, to unite them all would take forever. So I gathered just what I could. Look to the stars from where I stood, that I could leave behind this mountain, behind this city, behind this hood, behind this street, behind this road, behind this pass that leaves me cold. I'll fly so high they'll never find me, I'll never go back to the days of old. But as I flap and flap and flap, there are no wings upon my back. There is no magical elevation, and my puppet strings are still attached. I raise my eyes up to the sky. I can look way beyond this mountain high. I look to the heavens to just ask why this world won't get off my back and let me fly. But I'm stuck at the bottom with my regrets, with that single feather that I now possess. One day I'll reach that mountain top, but I'll have to do it step by step.
Thanks, Jay. That was absolutely beautiful.
Cheers.
Writer's block.
Oy. Wow.
Firstly, what have you done to overcome writer's block in the past? And perhaps advice, having been in that situation, I'm sure, you would give to young poets or young songwriters?
Okay, well, I guess writer's block is it's the eternal demon of all writers, because what's the worst thing about writer's block is that you remember the moments when the words flow so easily, you know? So like that Martin Luther King poem, I probably wrote that in about 20 minutes. Do you know
really?
What I mean? Yeah, it just flowed. It just came and flowed.
Amazing.
It just in my brain, straight through my arm to the pen, bang, on the
wrote
page.
Wrote itself almost.
Yeah, yeah, wrote itself. Just slight editorial changes, you know what I mean, right? But then you've got ones where you've got a great idea and you know the idea is great, but it's not coming out. And I think that, like, sometimes so one time I wrote a poem about writer's block, which I thought was quite witty. So I thought, oh, that's good, I'm being really witty, you know, postmodern, write a poem about writer's block, you know. And then afterwards you get writer's block after that and it doesn't work. So writer's block is stronger than you. I think sometimes you got to just sort of keep writing. Who's that guy? Is it what's that guy's name? Is it Richard Herring? He does that blog, yeah. Warming Up, you know,
where
he writes something every single day.
Oh, right.
And he tries to, you know, crack a joke, you know, and...
Well, Tom York from Radiohead writes a song a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, to get through.
There you go,
yeah,
just to get through it. So even if it's crap, then it's just a sort of like... if you look at the brain as being a muscle, and I believe there's a, like, a spiritual path between the brain and your hands, right, where... When you're writing, that path is clear, you know? It's like there's nothing getting in the way of it. So when the thought comes into your mind, bang, it comes onto the paper. And so if you can get into that mind state where it's literally the words are just like just being typed out across the screen on the inside of your eyelids,
yeah,
and then your pen just literally just transcribes them, right? Then you're there. And so even if it's... it's rubbish or it's nonsensical or it's just like it's you're finding yourself being pulled into a direction that you may not have wanted to be pulled into, allow yourself to dip into that darkness or that trivia or that nonsensical stuff, right? And I guarantee you, after a while, something, an idea, just a nub of an idea will be there. And so, you know, I'm not saying that write every single day, perform every single day, recite every single day. Write every single day if you can, and then put it away, and then you never know, maybe a year later, 2 years later, you look back at what you wrote and just be like, right, I know what I was trying to do. You can see all the struggling, and
yeah,
you say, I know what I was trying to do. And this, sometimes you write something and it doesn't work in that moment, and then you might save it for a little while and then bring it back a year later or 2 years later, and the poem is right for the moment.
Great advice. And in regards to inspiration, in regards to when you're writing, do you wait for ideas to come to you, or do you go looking for them?
Well, I guess because I've been a poet that is... The other guys on the scene, they call me a write-to-order poet. yeah, because, I mean, like I used to write for BBC Radio.
Yeah.
And, like, write a poem, like, almost every week about what's going on in the news.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
So there were many cases where, I remember, especially when Michael Jackson died. Right?
You did a great one.
Right? Yeah, that was written in an hour. Right?
That was brilliant.
Because I walked into the studio, right, in the morning, and I'd had another poem, right? And then the news of Michael Jackson dying had come in, and the producer just went, look, unless you've got something about Michael Jackson, the poem you've written, I can't remember what it was about, right, you know?
Yeah.
That's not going to get put on. So I just said, okay, then, right, fine. Just give me about an hour and a half. Let me just go into a little room and sit down and write. So I'm very used to...
You work well under pressure, because, like, yeah, a lot of your best poems also, the ones you do at the end of Russell Brand.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Where it's like, it's all put together in the last kind
I
of...
I guess so, because I guess things become clear. Like, what I tend to do is, like, especially when I was writing on Russ's show, is that I would see all the... I'd write, scribble little notes, you know, oh, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened. And then suddenly, you just sort of see an idea, or you see a concept, or you see a journey. So sometimes I'd see us all being... I think I wrote one where... We were all on a pirate ship, and yeah, Russell was a captain, and Matt was the first mate, and I think walking the plank. And so you start to sort of visualize it, and because we're all creative minds, they don't mind it being portrayed like that. Do you know what I'm saying? So you don't feel any inhibition to then just go completely abstract, right, and lay the poem out like that, because then it's, you know, you're doing what you're set out to do. You're being poetical, you know, you're allowed to be poetical. And so I find that, like, that I can very easily write to order, but every now and then you do get a gem. You just get a beautiful gem that just, like, an idea just bang comes in your head, and then you just say, okay, well, why don't I just run with that? You know, that's a good little idea. Like, there was a poem that I wrote recently, well, not recently, about maybe a year and a bit ago. It was about, two red robins, right? Two birds having a conversation, and it just came into my head. And there's no reasoning behind it. It just came into my head. I liked it and just went with it.
Cool. You just mentioned working on the Russell Brand Show. I know Noel Gallagher's obviously a guest on there quite a lot, and I know you've chatted to him about writing and poetry.
Yeah.
Tell us what Noel's like and what conversations you've had with him, because we've got a lot of listeners who are big fans of Noel.
The thing about Noel Gallagher, right? I mean, like, I know that, you know, he's got the whole Manchester swagger, and he's got the whole tough guy image, and he'll probably hate me for saying this, right? But I really admire him. I really admire him. Because, like, especially when you worked on Russell's show, like, it would be like me and Matt. Nobody knows who the hell we are. Everybody knows Russell, right? Mm-hmm. So you'd get some guests. I ain't going to mention no names, but, I mean, they would sort of, like, walk past us and then chat to Russ, whatever, and then when the show was over, they'd go away, right? Whereas Noel would sit down and chat to you, like, have a full-on conversation with you. You know what I mean? He'd talk to me. He'd talk to Matt. Him and Matt got on like a house on fire. He'd talk to the dude that makes the tea. He'd talk to the guy that answers the phones. Do you know what I'm saying? He's
down to earth, yeah.
He's proper. Like, I know it's such a cliche thing to say, but he's proper down to earth to a point where you actually forgot that he was a singer, right? And I remember one time we did a show. We did a live radio show at the Bloomsbury Theatre, right? And so we're all on stage. I'm there making my notes, doing poetry. And Noel comes on, and Noel's chatting away. So chatting, right? I think someone brought a guitar,
yeah,
right? And they handed him a guitar. And they say, oh, go on, sing, right? And then he sang. I think, I can't remember the song that
Don't
he
Look
sang.
Back Anger.
Yeah, no, it wasn't Don't Look Back Anger. It was, oh, God, I've forgotten it. Oh, no, it's going to bug me now, right? But he sang this song, right? I think it's important to being earnest, right?
The importance of being idle, right?
Yeah. You know? Oh, my God. And then I just sat there and goes, oh, my God, this is Noel Gallagher. It just hit me. I was like, this is Noel Gallagher. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because he's such a regular, down-to-earth, laugh, joke, do you know what I'm saying? Pull his star card out on you,
and
try and trump you, you know what I'm saying, right? On the show, there's banter, do you know what I'm saying? So everyone's got to play their roles and whatever. So, you know, I'm the poet, you know, Russ is the crazy celebrity, Noel brings him down a peg, Matt brings him down a peg, do you know what I'm saying? But I'm talking about when you're just sitting there hanging out or whatever, you know, he's really, right, I respect him a lot. I respect him a lot for that.
Good stuff. And, I mean, you've had chats to him. I think did he come on your show? Did you interview him?
Yeah, he came on my show. I did a show called Rhyme and Reason where I interviewed songwriters about about their poetical influences. And so he,
John Cooper Clarke, he's quite...
quite a John Cooper Clarke, because John Cooper Clarke was, you know, called the Bard of Salford, and he is the... he's one of the godfathers of what I do. Do you know what I'm saying? Right? So if you're talking about a lineage, you know, you've got people like the Benjamin Zephaniahs, the John Cooper Clarkes, the Gene Vinterbreezes, the John Hegleys. These are spoken word artists, people that have stood on stage with their craft and crafted out poetry to make it entertaining, you know? And so, but there again, right? Noel Gallagher, he used to go see John Cooper Clarke before he was famous. He used to go see a poet called Lem Cissé. Lem Cissé is well known in my community, do you know what I'm saying? In the poetry community, right? From Manchester, you know, back in the 80s or whatever.
Oh, really?
Noel Gallagher, I think one of the first times I ever had a deep conversation with Noel, he just said, yeah, I used to see a poet called Lem Cissé. And I was like, oh my God, wow, that's amazing, you know? So that's what I'm saying. He can relate to you on that level, do you know what I'm saying, right? And so I said to him, you know what, man, it would be really great if you, like, you know, we're talking about poetry, and I know that, like, a lot of people are going to just assume that, like, okay, you're influenced by the Beatles, you're influenced by Clapton, you're influenced by the whole 60s, 70s scene, right? But I said, no one's going to imagine that you'll be into poetry, right?
Definitely not. Yeah.
And it's a pity we didn't have, like, a lot of time, because that show was sort of like an Easter special, so we didn't really have enough time to delve into it. But I spoke to him for a long time. He's very much into, First World War poetry and stuff like that. There's a recording somewhere in the BBC, right, vault somewhere, of him reading out Flanders Fields, right? You know, yeah, because
really,
that, I'm telling you, seriously. So
dig it out.
What? Nah, they own that. They own that now. Do you know what I'm saying? That's owned by them. So, and then he like started talking about his songwriting technique.
Yeah.
So I think he was said like there was he'd seen something on TV, and there was a woman crying over her son, right? Mm. And she said one word. And that one word sparked off a whole song for
me. And that was Soulja Boy.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And I like that, again, because obviously people who are going to understand what I did on that show are generally songwriters, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I meet another songwriter and they tell me something like that, I'm like, wow, that's interesting to a songwriter, because there's like a common language that we speak where we're looking into the cosmos or into the atmosphere, and we're just trying to pick out stories or pick out ideas and then take it somewhere else. And so I think that that's where he's got like a mutual respect for me, and I've got a definite respect for him just on the songwriting level, you know what I mean? Because he's very, very good at that. He doesn't let anything go.
Cool. Obviously, it's a subject that we probably can't talk about in too much detail because there's probably loads of legal stuff. But in regards to the incident that stopped the show being going out
Sags,
anymore.
Was it Sagsgate? Yeah, right.
Obviously, I know you can't talk about it. It's, but what I wanted to ask about that, what advice would you give to young people going through and becoming, if you like, famous in inverted commas, and seeing, like, you basically saw your mate Russell being absolutely slaughtered in the press. And, like, that must have been really difficult.
I'll be honest with you, because, you know, the thing is, like, I've known him for a very long time, so I understand the Marmite effect, right? I understand that some people look at him and just think, I don't like him. Some people look at him and think, oh my God, this person's the most amazing thing in the world, right? I understand that, you know, that he puts himself out there and he generates that level of interest. But behind all the cameras flashing and behind the cars and the limousine and the girls and the stories or whatever, there's a person underneath all that. Do you know what I'm saying? There's a person that's you know, has a family, that is going through life, waking up in the morning, trying to figure out what is this whole journey of life all about. There's a person doing that as well. And so I'll be honest with you, like, seeing him go through that kind of, like, pressure, like, the whole idea of being famous, to me, I could never do that, because it's too much, because, like, it almost rips you apart, you know? And then once it's ripped you apart, it just looks at you in your crumpled up state and just goes, look at this guy, he used to be somebody, and now look at him, he's ripped apart, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not saying we ripped you apart, you know what I mean, you know? But then, I guess saying that, I mean, you know, once you step on the stage, you have to obey the rules of the stage, which is to entertain the audience. And if the audience switch on you, then you just got to face a tomato in the face. You know what I mean?
Who fucking Jonathan Ross's fault?
That's besides the point. I mean, I tend to look at it as being, like, what? I mean, like, what I found amazing, especially if you go back to like the timeline, was that like around the same time, Barack Obama had just won the elections. The Lehman Brothers had just crashed. This is the beginning of the credit crunch. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. The beginning of the recession, right? And so you've got two worldwide events, do you know what I mean, that people are still talking about today. And then you're going to throw that in as well? You know what I mean? That's going to take up front page. Are you kidding me? Do you know what I'm saying? You ain't got nothing better to talk about, right? And that's what I was amazed. I was amazed that, oh my God, that this little thing has blown up so big. And I just genuinely believe that, like, I suppose maybe, I don't know, like, I guess, you know, Russell and Jonathan, they just represented the height of celebrity and the height of fame and the height of excess and all the things that come with it, right? And so when you have these, like the something like a credit crunch occurring, it's almost like everybody's got to be brought down a peg, you know what I mean? And so like the mud really came out, you know? And not just to say, it's not even just that. The bottom line is that it was a show. A lot of people had jobs. A lot of people had family, depending on that kind of stuff. Definitely. You know what I'm saying? It affected way more people than you will ever, ever know. Yeah. You know what I mean? Even to this day, it's affected people.
Yeah.
You know? But, I mean, again, you know, you step on the stage and I guess you just have to, you know, it's not an accident when you go into a theatre, you see one smiley face and one crying face. You know what I mean? Because it's the same face.
How did it affect you? I know you, were you worried? Because that was your problem.
Not really. I'll be honest with you. I think that, like, what affected me was just the being harassed by the press, right?
You got that as well, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, like, I say this to a lot of people that, like, whenever people talk about, like, oh, I'll never sell out, I'll never do this, I'll never do that, I'll keep my integrity. If you have someone from the press offering you, you know, a check for 25 grand to expose everyone who you like and love, do you know what I mean? And you turn it down, that's pretty serious, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
You know, they offered a lot of money to get an expose. And, not just me, but, you know, the producer of the show, a lot of other people got offered silly money, you know what I mean? To just throw everyone in to the pit, right? And I'm very proud of the fact that everybody held tight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we all kept our ground. And no, if you look at any story on that, no one that actually worked on the show spilled the beans on anyone else that worked on the show. You know what I mean? Mm. And I'm very proud about that because the show wasn't put together just for fame or whatever. It was put together out of love. You know what I mean?
And it was brilliant.
It's a bunch of guys that loved each other. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah, right? Yeah. And we kicked it together and we hung out together. And you know what I mean? So you couldn't rip us apart like that. Do you know what I'm saying? Right? Because the bonds were a lot stronger than just like, oh, these guys are just trying to do this for effect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right?
And you definitely felt that listening to
apologies
it.
To anyone that got hurt or whatever, but it didn't, no one set out to do that show to hurt anyone. We just wanted to make people laugh. That's really all we wanted to do.
Obviously, Russell's a very big personality. You mentioned Jonathan Ross, Noel Gallagher. What advice would you give to young people for the first time working with big personalities?
Hold on tight, man. It's going to be a crazy ride. That's all I can say. I don't know. I just think that, like, I'll be honest with you, I've had a lot of fun, right? So I haven't had bad experiences. That's why it's difficult. You know, people try and say, oh, blah blah blah. You know, I've had a laugh, man. It's been a laugh. And I will say that, like, that when the spotlight does shine on someone, that sometimes it's not the person that changes, the people around them that change. You know what I mean? Sometimes you've really got to understand that amidst all that, right, that person's still there, you know? Mm-hmm. But you know, once the lights are on someone, you got to put on a show. Because, like, you know, I run a entertainment night called Chill Pill. And, you know, we had Ed Sheeran come down back in the day when he just a little dude with a guitar, just singing away, you know, and just chilling, right? Just a little guy, you know, do his little song. You know, you can Google and see Ed Sheeran appearing at Chill Pill, right?
Really?
You know, and just see him performing in a tiny little place.
You know, I
ran that night. And you know, you realize that, like, everyone that goes into, like, singing, being a comedian, you know, I won't say performing poetry, that's not really, like, no one's really superstar on that level, right? But, like, acting, you know, they started off with a dream, right? And the dream was to entertain or put their stamp on this art form. And they've generally studied the greats, right? Yeah. You know, most people that are into music, whatever form of music it is, they would have looked at people that have done it before. Most people that do comedy, you speak to Russ. Russ is an expert on comedy. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Going way, way back, man. Mm. He can quote lines from 50 years ago and stuff like that, right?
Really? Right.
You know, Noel Gallagher, man, you know what I mean? He can tell you about guitar riffs from old blues players that you never even heard of, you know what I mean, right? And so everyone's just trying to do their thing. But the fickle finger of fate, it will only tickle a few, you know what I mean, voices. And it will only tickle a few personalities, and it'll tickle a few, you know. And so only a few people are going to make it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if they do make it, then it's just, it's crazy from then on in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so some people get out of it with their sanity intact. Some people have breakdowns. Some people lose, make loads of money, lose loads of money. Some people, you know, lose good friends, lose wives, husbands, lose family members. You know what I mean? It can be so crazy that you can actually lose more than you ever gain, right? And so just be wary if anyone that is looking and all they can see is just the spotlight and pretty girls and a big fancy car and, you know, a nice home and whatever. These things come with a cost.
Mm.
And sometimes the cost might be more than your soul can pay.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, well, I'm a poet, innit?
Is there any other advice you would give actually writers, maybe technical advice in actually kind of writing poems or writing lyrics from a technical point of view? Or perhaps do you agree with like poetry courses and stuff like that? Or is that a bit fake? Or
I would say whatever works for you. I do lots of workshops. I do lots of workshops in prisons, especially, right? You know, I've probably been inside almost every single jail in the UK, to be honest with you, right? You know, for legal reasons, you know?
Yeah.
But I would just say that, like, go through your record collection, right? Go through the books that you like to read. Go through the films that you like to watch, right? And the reason why you like a particular film, or that you like a particular song, or you like a particular book, is because it is speaking to something inside you, right? So generally, if you took all the things that you like and actually tried to analyze, what is it I like about this thing, right? Because that's what it is you like about yourself, right? And you can actually start to find yourself, you know? And so that's why you will hear a person say, oh, when Clapton played on this tune, do you know what I'm saying? Oh, I just wanted to capture something to be like that. What was it? Jimi Hendrix said that he wanted to play his guitar the way Little Richard sang. You know what I mean?
Yeah, great
right?
quote. Yeah.
Because Little Richard's singing said something to Jimi Hendrix, and Jimi Hendrix like, I can't sing like that, but I'm going to find a way to get that emotion back out again.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you look at it like that, whereby it's not a case of like saying, you know, I'm not saying go copy someone, you know, left, right and center, but look at it, or all the influences in your life. Some of them might be from the world of celebrity, movie, TV, all that stuff. Some of them might just be, you know, might be your mum and dad, might be your brother, your sister, it might be the dude that lives up the street, it might be your best friend, it might be all these things go into the making of you. And then you then define what it is, whatever your craft is, be it the comedy, be it the poetry, be it writing, be it music, right? And then you then express that out. And once you start to, the first few times are going to be, you know, they're going to be, you know, taking baby steps, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But eventually you'll start to find a voice or a style or a feeling that you're comfortable with, right? And then what you then find is that you will then attract people that are interested in that. So, as I said, I do poetry, you know what I mean? I ain't going to attract hardcore comedy fans. I ain't going to attract, people that are serious, you know, Shakespearean actors, whatever. I ain't going to attract people that are hardcore hip-hop heads, you know what I'm saying, right? But there might be, amongst the whole crowd, there might be one or two people who just think, yeah, you know what? I actually just like the poetry. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be my audience. And so then you then go and find your audience and service your audience.
Great stuff, great advice. Are there any fears for the arts, the future in arts, that, and if so, how might they be addressed for you?
Fears?
Do you have any concerns about the...
Nah, I don't know. I know that, like, obviously, because we're in the doldrums of, of very, like, right-wing government, and there's loads and loads of cuts and stuff like that, and so a lot of people moan about, oh, the arts are being cut and theatres are being closed down or whatever. But I'm a realist, so I'd rather they cut a theatre and then close a hospital. Do you know what I'm saying? I'll be honest with you, right?
Yeah,
but then again, I'd rather they keep a theatre open than bomb a country. Do you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
But art will always find its way. People will always feel the need to express themselves. People always need to hear beautiful words. People always need to hear songs that uplift them, songs that take them in different directions, songs that just have them jumping up and down on a Saturday night when they're out of their heads. People always have that need, you know? And every generation is coming into awareness. So you're always going to have like a generation of teenagers or people in their early 20s that are coming into an awareness, and they've got an understanding of the time now, and they will need their anthems, they will need their films, they will need their songs, they will need their books, they will need art to replicate the feelings that they feel for today. And so I just believe that, you know, the art is going to be with man from the moment we drew on cavemen walls to the moment that the sun implodes in itself. Yeah.
Good stuff. Nice one. Okay, what's next for Mr. G? Are you doing more of the Chill Pill nights at all?
Yeah, Chill Pill for me is like, I guess it's sort of like, it's my, it's me trying to give back to the scene that birthed me, right? I was very, very lucky in the sense that, like, I ran a night called Brixstung in Brixton for a very long time. I was very fortunate to be able to be on BBC Radio, fortunate to hang out with people like Russ and Matt, you know what I mean, and do stuff with them and tour the world and do all that kind of great stuff. But I always wanted to set up a night for myself that would then have other people, you know, come through and perform. And so I'm working with like extremely talented artists, a guy called Raymond Anchibus, Deanna Roger, Adam Kamerling, Simon Mole. These are like on my scene, they're gods and
goddesses. Cut them from Brighton, is that what? Right?
Yes, exactly. And so Adam and Simon are from Brighton, well known in Brighton, And so we're just trying to put on very entertaining, enjoyable spoken word poetry nights to the quality where you would just say, okay, today I'll go and see a music act, tomorrow I'll go see a comedy act, maybe the day after I'll go see a spoken word act. What do you want to go see? Chill Pill, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just taking the art form and just taking it a few notches up.
And where and when is it?
Yeah, we got a night on in March. It's on Thursday the 10th of March at the Albany. That's in Deptford in South London. If you go to chill-pill.co.uk or just Google Chill Pill Poetry, you'll get our website and you'll see all the up and coming shows that we've got going on.
Awesome, I'll pop down, that sounds brilliant. We'll get a few of our fans down there. Okay, so just want to say thanks very much for appearing on the Stage Left podcast. I think a lot of the people, you know, we have a lot of musicians and a lot of lyricists and a lot of songwriters in the early stage of their career, and I think just listening to you talk about poetry so passionately and kind of your views on life and how that entwines with your art is something we can all learn from, and I think it's been really fascinating insight, and I really appreciate you coming down and appearing on the Stage Left podcast.
Thanks very much, Chris.
For more episodes featuring musicians who've worked with the likes of Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, The Prodigy, Oasis, go to www.thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @TheStageLeftPod, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheStageLeftPodcast. See you next time.